young officer was new, pressed into duty after Adams's executive officer had died in the crash. The Sanaban liquid he had sprayed on Adams's wound would set in 60 seconds, creating a hard but porous membrane over the wound site. It also contained a long-acting local anesthetic, but the lieutenant needed to work quickly to debride the wound before the spray set, or the wound would seal around the dirt. Adams kept silent, both cursing himself for wanting to be the first Marine to land and counting himself lucky for surviving the fall that had made that wish come true. Using a pair of tweezers from the med kit, Jacobson worked out one last piece that had been lodged just under the general's lip.
"Got it,"
said the aide, proudly holding up in his tweezers a sliver of a wooden golf tee the size of a matchstick. Adams could only think that it made the young officer look even younger, like one of his sons playing the board game Operation. Fortunately, the numbness from the anesthetic had set in by this point. As the general rubbed his jaw, testing the edge of it, a helmetless Marine jumped off the roadway and into the culvert.
"Sir, Colonel Forrest sent me back to let you know that we've got enemy armor coming," said the Marine, trying to catch his breath.
Adams couldn't read his name, a scarlet slash of blood painted across the body armor, just his insignia, a corporal.
"How far, Corporal?"
Adams asked, his speech slurred by the anesthetic. He looked over in anger at Jacobson.
"How far out are they, Corporal?"
The general's aide translated.
"Scouts tracking them about a click away from our position, headed out from the old Schofield barracks," said the corporal unfazed.
It was the first time he'd ever talked to a general up close. For all he knew, they always had their aides translate for them. He handed the general a muddy map he'd been given to deliver. The units had been ordered to stay off networks as much as they could.
"Knew your luck run out eventually," Adams said, mostly to himself.
Except for his falling out of the back of an Osprey and onto a golf course, the operation had gone about as well as could be expected. Stealing a play from the Russians, they'd launched from the fleet almost 400 miles out, the maximum range they could fly without refueling. They had cut it close, all but one of the tilt-rotor aircraft making it in on fumes. The strikes from the Z and the Poles had given them a lane through the air defenses, and even better than expected. The initial reaction from the ground defenses had been fierce, but localized. It was as if the various directorate units were operating without any leadership from the top. Adams didn't know if it was due to the jamming or a lucky hit from the shore bombardment that had killed a directorate general. He didn't care. He would take a confused enemy every time. The downside of their long-range method of infiltration was that his units were fighting lighter than normal. While each of the Ospreys that had landed at locations all up and down the North Shore could carry 24 combat-loaded Marines, they couldn't carry the unit's complement of artillery or vehicles. The Marines had commandeered civilian vehicles to stay mobile, but they would have to wait for the landing craft to bring them their own armored firepower.
"Colonel Forrest said to tell you that he can bring them under fire to delay," said the scout, "but he is requesting to blow the two bridges just north of town, sir."
Adams studied the cracked screen of his tablet computer, matching the map to the locations he knew by heart. They could blow the bridges over the Anahulu River, but that would leave his forces on the wrong side of the little harbor in Haleiwa. And he wanted that harbor. As dinky as it was, hosting mostly deep-sea fishing charters before the war, Haleiwa had the only pier on the entire north side of the island. His Marines could cross the beach, but that little harbor would make offloading the 11th Cavalry far easier. And, more important, he didn't want to lose momentum, never give an enemy the opportunity to catch his breath. Instead, grind your boot down hard on his neck. He pointed on the map to the juncture of Highways 83 and 99, and the section just beyond Haleiwa, where the main road was raised on concrete pillars above the marshy land and small streams.
"Tell the Z to hurt her and her."
He looked over at the young Marine corporal, who was waiting to be dismissed.
"Nam, son," said General Adams.
"Name, corporal?" the aide asked.
"Snyder, sir," said the corporal.
"Good job, Snyder,"
Adams said slowly, trying to enunciate each word. He nodded at the aide to get to work. Jacobson pointed a baseball bat-size antenna out to sea and set up a directed microwave burst transmission to the task force. The signal's frequency hopped with each transmission, allowing it to slip through the directorate jamming.
Longboard, longboard, this is Ares, requesting fire at forward, Quebec, Delta, Kilo, Zero, Tree, Niner, 8, Tree, 0, 6, 2, Niner, and at forward, Quebec, Delta, Kilo, 0, 4, 1, 2, 4, Tree, 0, 2, Niner, 0.
Confirm, longboard, said the aide, using the military's phonetic pronunciation for the grid coordinates to ensure distinct sounds.
Ares, this is Longboard Actual. Copy all, but what's the situation?
Where is Ares Actual? Over.
Adams recognized the voice as Admiral Murray's.
Longboard Actual. I've got Ares Actual right beside me, but he is, verbally incapacitated. I'll be speaking for him. Wait, Jacobson said.
Tell her that.
Before Adams could finish, the young officer started.
Longboard Actual presents status strong but precarious. Enemy armor column advancing down Route 99. We'll need fire support to block threat.
But not just yet. It'll cost us. But we want to wait for max effect.
I will relay fire order to time for exactly when their column crosses Halemano Stream.
Adams eyed the young lieutenant with newfound respect. He was crap at surgery, but he was a bloody-minded killer. Just the way they'd taught at Quantico.
Highway 99, Oahu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone.
Snyder, are you sure this is what the general said to do?
Lance Corporal Ramona Vetter fired off another 10-round burst from her M240 machine gun. The bullets bounced off the lead tank, a Type 99, whose brown and green camouflage paint stood out on the highway's black asphalt. It was belching smoke from where its engine used to be after a direct hit from a Javelin shoulder-fired rocket. Their machine gun fire wouldn't cause any damage, but it would keep the crew from exiting.
Well, not exactly this, said Snyder, pointing his M4 rifle at the next tank in line, which was pushing the damaged tank off the road.
Through his tactical glasses, he could see the directorate tank designated with a bright green halo. With the road cleared, the tank began to advance toward them again. Another Javelin missile was fired off, but it was deflected by the tank's active protection defenses, which shot down the incoming missile with a small rocket that detonated the threat 50 meters away. When the tank finally reached the small stream, Snyder did just what the lieutenant had instructed him to do. Normally, he knew to ignore what lieutenant said, but the general beside him had nodded his approval. He toggled the glasses menu with the controller mounted on the forward rail of his M4. The connection relayed back to the young lieutenant's transmission out to sea. And after a few seconds, the system began to push data to Snyder's glasses, detailing the incoming fire's expected blast radius.
Damn, you should see this, Vetter, said Snyder.
He panned his head left and then right. Hundreds of meters out from the projected impact point on the tank, his glasses showed all red, with a warning signal overlaid in bold. Danger close.
Whatever they're firing, it isn't in the system.
Figured it would be a 5-incher, but it's something else.
Bigger than a 5-incher, you promise? Said Vetter.
You know, your dirty mouth is going to ruin our Hawaiian honeymoon, said Snyder.
He yelled to the rest of their platoon strung out along the road.
Incoming fire, danger close, get your asses down!
Probably just can't shoot straight, typical Navy, said Vetter.
The two of them lay prone in a muddy ditch.
Yeah, well, you know who the colonel is going to blame when this kills us all? Me, said Snyder.
He'd barely finished speaking when the roadway before them vaporized in a bloom of orange and white flame. The blast wave lifted Snyder and Vetter a few inches off the ground and then dropped them back into the ditch. Their ears ringing so loud they couldn't hear anything. They edged back up to the lip. The roadway was now a massive crater where the two lead tanks had been. Even tanks farther away in the column had been flipped onto their backs like turtles. A second wave of railgun fire came in, lifting Snyder and Vetter up again. The effect on the roadway was like scattering hot coals with a sledgehammer. A few seconds later, another two rounds landed in the traffic circle just to the west. Now both roads into town were blocked. Vetter was saying something, but Snyder couldn't hear her over the ringing in his ears. He scanned across the scene of destruction, with his eyewear, tagging each smoldering crater and piece of smoking wreckage with a red circle. The message to the Zumwalt's Athena system was simple. Targets destroyed. USS Zumwalt Ship Mission Center. The battle had settled into a rhythm, a steady monotone patter of queries and replies, as the ship and its crew carried out fire support missions onshore. The only physical indicator that they were at war was the sound of the room's cooling fans, which seemed to be working extra hard. The holograph map now showed the Z, joined by the rest of the task force, an arc of escort ships surrounding a convoy of transport vessels, all moving closer to shore. A blue bubble overhead extending almost 110 miles out indicated the air defense range provided by the USS Port Royal, the Aegis cruiser accompanying the task force. Beyond it, small moving icons indicated the Mako ships sweeping for underwater threats, and a small combat air patrol of 6 F-35Bs overhead. They were from the USS America, the amphibious assault ship at the center of the task force. The America also served as Admiral Murray's flagship, and was so marked with a boulder icon. The America lacked an aircraft catapult launch and arrestment recovery equipment, which meant it could carry only those aircraft that could take off and land vertically, like F-35Bs, helicopters, and Ospreys. But for all other purposes, it was essentially a 45,000-ton aircraft carrier that could also load 2,500 Marines and, more important, it ran on non-nuclear engines. The mission planners had swapped out its normal heavy helicopter complement for the bulk of the first Osprey wave, which were joined by other Ospreys that had flown off the accompanying San Antonio and Austin-class landing ships brought out of retirement in the Ghost Fleet. The arrival of so many of the big, slow, non-stealthy ships meant Task Force Longboard's presence would now be much more evident to any directorate sensors, but being surrounded by other ships felt comforting to all in the Z. "Captain, we have an incoming drone from the north," a sailor announced. "Its squawking code says point of origin is Shemya?" Cortez started to read off his glasses. "Shemya, Aleutian Islands. There's an old Air Force weather station there that has an emergency landing airfield. Not so great for that. Says the wind never drops below 60 miles per hour, and there's a 10-foot visibility fog 300 days of the year. That explains it. Robots don't mind the weather. Op plan has it used as a relay station for secure drone comms. A Pony Express-style handover. Allow download. It is about time we finally get some news on what's happening up north," said the captain. Within a minute, Cortez appeared at Simmons's side with a tablet screen. It showed an animated map of the current and projected locations of the U.S. forces making their way through the Arctic Passage. Noticeably absent was the Directorate battle fleet that was supposed to have been drawn north. "Shit," said Simmons. Cortez nodded, and he winced slightly as he read the message aloud. "No contact Directorate battle fleet. Undetected from searches in Bering and off Aleutians. In absence of further information, must assume strong substantial attack force proceeding towards your area of operations. In carrying out the task assigned in Operation Plan 2942, you will be governed by the principle of calculated risk, which you shall interpret to mean the avoidance of exposure of your force to attack by superior enemy forces without good prospect of inflicting greater damage to the enemy. Given communications link delays and uncertainty, decision authority is now with Task Force Commander. COMPACOM will support, but priority is to protect the fleet in being. Sir, we have Admiral Murray on the localized net for you," Cortez said. The video link opened and the Admiral appeared. "You've seen the message?" she asked.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then you know what it means," she asked.
"Yes. Packham is not going to say it, but they're giving us the option to withdraw if the situation turns too hairy," he responded, "which would hang the Marines on shore out to dry."
"That is indeed what it means, Captain," she said. "That's the trade-off. Instead of being puppeted from afar like in the last war, we get the kind of command freedom our predecessors dreamed of. But it also means the hard calls get piled on our shoulders." Simmons' eyes flashed up to the monitor bank, showing the array of system updates and videos of Marine combat footage. How many hours had it been since he'd seen the sea? It should have been easy to follow a cold-hearted, calculated order like this, because he was devoid of any physical contact with the war, and was essentially playing a video game in this floating box. It wasn't. "We will proceed as planned," said Murray. "But be aware of the operation if needed. I'll give General Adams the bad news myself." No more than 10 minutes after she had signed off, another urgent transmission came in. "It's the bird on the Northwest Patrol," Cortez said, pointing to the icon on the holographic tactical display. "Let's hear it," said Simmons. "Big Bird, double down 4, said the female pilot. "You have an incoming flight of 60-plus enemy jets, I repeat, 60-plus enemy jets, coming from the northwest. They've got carriers out there somewhere. Double down 4 is engaging, but..." The pilot trailed off. They all knew. It was best left unsaid. Her F-35B was one of the handful of jump jets squeezed onto the USS America to form the task force's combat air patrol. Given what had happened to their predecessors, all the pilots had been volunteers. Their planes had been scanned and rescanned, and as many of the suspect chips swapped out as possible, replaced with chips scavenged from donated commercial gear. But there was no certainty they'd removed all of the Trojan horse hardware. The technicians likened it to trying to find a particular needle in a haystack made of needles. But finding bad chips was actually even harder than that, as they activated only in the presence of a combination of an unknown frequency and an encrypted transmittal message. Her voice sounded strange as she braced against the increasing G-load that went with her aggressive tactical turn toward the threat in the northwest. The flight suit fought the physics of the maneuver, but it was always a losing battle. "We'll do what we can, but expect incoming within 15 minutes. Double down, 4 out." Double down 4 stopped transmitting and fired a salvo of joint dual-role air dominance missiles at the squadron of Chinese Shenyang J-31 fighters that had entered the defense sector. The Chinese planes were almost her jet's twins. Having benefited during their development from F-35 blueprints stolen by hackers in 2009, her incoming missile warning alerted her that the closest one had counterfired a PL-21D. Powered by ramjets, it closed quickly, so she banked hard and up to get some altitude. Then she activated the broadcast protocol. To counter the risk of some traitor chip signaling out, the whiz kids had dreamed up the idea of flooding all the frequencies. All stealth was lost, but the theory was that whatever homing beacon the missiles were trying to ride in on would be overwhelmed by all the other signals broadcasting. She rotated the plane, so she was inverted, catching a glimpse of the incoming missile exhaust streaking toward her as she did. The F-35 automatically fired off a dozen flares, and she put the plane straight down into a dive that made it crack the sound barrier. The missile kept climbing past her, seemingly fooled for the moment. Double down 4 turned again, visually hunting for another target. Her search radar, rendered useless by the mix of the enemies and her own jamming. In the distance, she saw an explosion. At least one of her missiles had made contact. All of this wore invisible to the Zumwalt's crew, still haunted by the clipped tone of her transmission. Jamming made it impossible for them to hear anything more. This spared the crew from hearing Double Down 4's choked scream, as 30-millimeter cannon fire from a Russian Su-33 gutted her plane's belly. The only indication of her fate came when the all-frequency jamming stopped, and Athena changed the F-35 icon from blue to gray, and then moved it off the screen.
"Ladies and gentlemen, it seems we have found the rest of the enemy fleet," said Simmons. "You know what to do."
Wolf Flight, Pacific Ocean. Some 120 miles away from the Zumwalt, Captain Second Rank Alexei Denisov swept the sky again, craning his neck to look past his MiG-35K's twin tails. He wanted to confirm what his cockpit displays and flight communications told him. The last of the American Combat Air Patrol had been shot down. He looked around his plane. All that remained was a faint haze of smoke from the dogfight. This was a perfect coda, he believed. He had been there at the beginning, and he would be there at the end of it all. How many decades had the Americans claimed the world's skies? No more.
White and red squadrons, this is Dagger 334. Sky looks clear of any enemy planes.
He checked his radar screen again. Still no targets acquired. Both sides were jamming each other, and neither could cut through the electronic fog until they closed.
Begin your attack, Formation Wolf Hunt, said Denisov.
Denisov pulled back on the stick and slowed, allowing the aircraft to reposition itself into the attack formation. Within seconds, the Russian MiG-35Ks and Su-33s of White Squadron and the Chinese J-31s of Red Squadron were neatly arrayed in a line extending 200 kilometers, just as they had trained on the simulators for weeks. Like wolves on the Siberian plains, they would sweep forward until some part of the line made contact. Then all the others would close in a circle. It was simple, but brutally effective.
USS Zumwalt Ship Mission Center.
Damn it to hell, said an angry voice, not bothering to keep her frustration in check. The sailor was just out of Simmons's line of sight, but her frustration was clear. He walked down the stairs to the sailor's workstation.
Patience, Richter, just have patience, said Simmons in a calming voice.
Aye, sir, said Operations Specialist Angelique Richter, a bit surprised to find the captain leaning over her shoulder to look at the three screens at the workstation she was using. A diminutive 25-year-old radar systems operator, she wore a matte black eyebrow stud, like the ones many of the female Marines wore.
Might as well turn the damn thing off, sir. Jamming's only getting worse.
Ebb and flow, Richter. That's how this is going to go, said Simmons. You get a glimpse, then you use what little you have. Don't forget, they're just as confused as we are.
The girl nodded, running chewed fingernails over her shaved head.
Richter, you've been in 3 years now, right? Said Simmons.
It will be 4 years and 2 months, sir, she said.
That's a lot of Navy in your blood, said Simmons. Makes you one of the sailors I'm counting on today. There's nothing here you can't handle. What we know is all we know. Got me?
Aye, sir.
He was walking back up the stairs to the observation floor when the radar operator called him.
Sir, we've bogies coming in from the northwest. They're strung out in a long line, Richter said.
Then, in a lower pitch, Athena counts 62 in total.
Shit, the radar operator continued. It's worse than that. Athena is now showing something coming in from the east. It's patchy, but at least 100 bogies. We're right square in the middle.
As the information from her screen began to populate the central tactical hologram where all could see it, the room seemed to grow more quiet. A brief groan from the ship's engines welled up through the hull, as if the Zumwalt had just accepted its fate. Then a voice rang out over the speakers arrayed around the room. It had a gravelly, southern twang.
Longboard, this is Boneyard 6-4. You seem to have some party crashers on the way. Can we be of assistance? Over.
Boneyard Flight, Pacific Ocean. U.S. Air Force Colonel Roscoe Colton ended the transmission and rechecked his position. The 12-by-19-inch glass panel Garmin Aero Screen was bolted on shock mounts over the F-15C jet's original flight instruments. He had rimmed the screen with duct tape for good measure, which showed the level of confidence he had in the technology. It was effective, but it still didn't seem right, which basically captured just about everything so far in this mission. Roscoe's jet had been among the 256 F-15s and F-16s the U.S. Air Force had early retired in 2014. The argument was that the fourth generation of fighter planes couldn't keep up with 21st century threats. But the real reason was that retiring the planes created an artificial fighter gap, which helped make the case for keeping the spending up on the F-35, the fifth generation plane, whose cost had spiraled. The old but still flyable planes had spent the past years stored out in the dry Arizona air of Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, better known as the Boneyard, the aircraft equivalent of the Ghost Fleet, alongside some 4,000 other retired planes dating back to World War II. Roscoe's jet had been waiting its turn to be harvested for scrap metal and spare parts. But now, the age of the planes in Boneyard Flight worked to their advantage. They were crude, but they could be trusted. First flown in the 1970s, the F-15s needed only rudimentary electronics to operate. They had less computing power than his grandson's talking toy bear, and were steered by about 20 million fewer lines of code than the F-35. More important, the chips in their flight systems had been produced long before hardware hacking or even the directorate itself had been conceived. His fuel gauge showed he had about 2 hours of flight time left if he just nursed the plane along. Unfortunately, the dogfight he expected would shave his time aloft down to a fraction of that. Boneyard flight had taken off with 24 desert-worn KC-135s that had also been pulled out of retirement. Those things were tougher than cockroaches. First flown back in the Eisenhower days, the 707 passenger jet derivatives did not have a modern chip anywhere, unlike the new KC-46s, which had turned out to be missile magnets like all the other Chinese chipped gear. The plan was that another flight of old Stratotankers would be waiting to refuel them on the return leg. He looked down at the rippled sea surface. It was a profoundly deep azure, dusted with white lines that reminded him of a light snow on tree branches back home in North Carolina. The tankers would be there. The briefer had promised. And if not, he said, the sea would contain only friendly ships they could ditch near. After 2 wives and 24 years in the Air Force, Roscoe knew when he was being bullshitted. He also knew when not to care.
Oscar, Roscoe, you picking up the same fleet data I am? Over, said Roscoe.
Roger that, Roscoe, said Oscar, an F-16 pilot flying the other element of the escort.
The pilot had gotten his call sign back when he was a new lieutenant, a way to put him in his place after he'd been hot-dogging it in flight school.
Sky is clear over Oahu, but the squids look like they're in for some major rain. Over.
I'm thinking we need to give them an umbrella. I'll take Eagle and Wally elements of the escort to mix it up. You take Viper element on with the big boys to keep them safe and give the ground pounders some support. Over.
Understood, Roscoe. Just like an Eagle driver to steal all the glory, Oscar responded.
We'll get him through. Good hunting, over.
Eagle flight, I know you heard that conversation. Form up on me.
Then he paused, and when he spoke again, he made sure to enunciate his words. They said the voice recognition software would work anyway, but he wanted to be certain.
Wall-E flight, authorization Roscoe, voice authenticate Eagle 2-8 Alpha Delta. New mission order, autonomous hunt, air-to-air weapons authority release, execute.
He turned his head to see if they would follow the order or just start shooting down all the American jets close to them, like some bad movie. But the 12 F-40A Shrikes in the escort all took a smooth, literally perfect turn with a precision that would make a flight instructor orgasm, and then formed up on the flanks of the Eagle Flight's F-15 fighters. To Roscoe, it was one of the war's many ironies that the jets they most needed to come through today were the very ones his service's leadership had done its best to fight for years. Unmanned planes had proved their worth in the Afghan War, and then in the various counterterrorism campaigns from Pakistan to Nigeria, but the early models had been remotely operated by pilots on the ground, and they were propeller-powered by 4-cylinder engines taken from snowmobiles, meaning they had performance capabilities that even a World War I pilot would laugh at. The generals had always made sure to tell the public that while they were fine for killing terrorists, the early drones wouldn't be able to survive in any kind of denied airspace. That was true enough, but oddly, behind the scenes, the critics did everything possible to make sure future models would have those very same flaws. The Pentagon bureaucracy, which had begrudgingly started using armed unmanned aerial systems only after the CIA got into the business, consistently slow-rolled any attempts to make the next generation of drones faster, stealthier, and more lethal. In the lean years after the Afghan War, the research budget for unmanned systems was slashed 4 times as much as any other program. The rationales for opposition included everything from worries about pilots losing jobs to defense contractors' concerns that the better the new technology became, the more it would threaten their already signed multi-trillion-dollar weapons contracts.
It got to the point that in 2013, when a test drone successfully took off and landed on an aircraft carrier by itself, the Naval Air Systems Command tried to send the cutting-edge technology not out to the fleet, but to the Smithsonian. There, in a museum, one of the most advanced planes on the planet could be celebrated, and more important, it wouldn't be carrying out any further tests that might make people rethink the existing order of things. The F-40 Shrike program had been proposed by a maverick colonel who'd risked his career by publishing an article about it in the U.S. Air Force's professional journal. He argued that instead of replacing its workhorse F-16 fighter Falcon jets with the heavy and expensive F-35s, the Air Force should go with a similarly lightweight, cheap, and durable plane. The only difference was that it would be unmanned. It would get a small radar signature from having a thin, tailless bat wing shape that the absence of a cockpit made possible. Its software would match capabilities that had already been proven effective in the civilian market, autonomous flight and navigation, with weapon software that would follow the same identification friend or foe protocols as missiles. While the idea was anathema to leadership at the time, the concept of a cheap, useful combat drone struck a chord with the researchers at DARPA. A prototype was funded, and it flew right about when Roscoe was starting his second marriage. But just like what happened to the Predator drone a generation before, the little Shrike languished in what was known in the Beltway as the Valley of Death, never rising to full program status with the Air Force or the major contractors. The program had received new life when all the agency's old prototypes were reevaluated for their utility in a new war. There, the DARPA connection proved critical again, as the Shrike's computer chips had been made through the agency's trusted foundry program, not sourced from the marked-up Chinese-made chips that the major contractors' weapons programs used. Initially, the old guard in the Air Force had wanted to strip out the chips and use them as part of a plan to ramp up production of the very same manned planes that had failed at the war's opening. But when Secretary of Defense Claiborne fired the Air Combat Command General who had proposed it and said she would use Navy planes exclusively for future missions if anyone came to her with any more such backward-looking ideas, the rest of the service got on board. It wasn't only because of that proposal that the general was fired. Claiborne had already been planning to fire him, but she had held back until she could do it in what she called a teachable moment. "Roscoe, one last thing," Oscar called over as he watched the drones form up beside the old F-15s. "You better shoot down more bogeys than those damn robots do, or you and I are truly going to be out of the business." Pua'ena Point Beach Park, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. Standing on the concrete slab that had been the foundation of the old radio tower, General Adams admired the controlled chaos. The last time this field had seen such a buzz of activity had been the original Day of Infamy itself. Back in 1941, the Haleiwa fighter strip had been a satellite landing field away from the main U.S. Army Air Corps base at Wheeler Airfield. As soon as the attack started, without waiting for orders, two young fighter pilots, Lieutenants George Welch and Kenneth Taylor, had jumped in a car and raced to the secondary field. They made the twisting 16-mile drive in under 15 minutes. When they arrived, the crew chiefs told them that instead of flying out, they would disperse the aircraft on the ground. "To hell with that," said Welch. Ignoring the usual pre-takeoff checklists, each pilot climbed into a P-40 Warhawk fighter plane and took off down the airstrip. Only once they were in the air did they figure out they were about to take on over 300 enemy aircraft. Undeterred, Welch and Taylor plowed straight into the second wave of the Japanese attack. They didn't stop the attack, but they did manage to shoot down six planes before they ran out of ammunition. More important, the two pilots put up enough of a fight that Japanese planners assumed there were far more defenders in the air. They decided against sending in a final third attack wave, designed to pummel Pearl Harbor's fuel storage, maintenance, and dry dock repair yards, an attack that would have set back the American war effort at least another year. The airstrip stayed in use up to the 1960s and was then turned over to the locals. Eventually owned by Kamehameha Schools and renamed Pua'ena Point, the real estate remained undeveloped. The concrete tarmac
becoming cracked and gradually overtaken by the jungle. The only human presence for the past decades had been a squatter's camp and an occasional rave party. This real estate was now priceless to Adams. All the other active airstrips on the island, even the small civilian fields, had been used by the directorate for basing and drone landing strips, and they'd been taken out by the Z's bombardment. A platoon of his Marines had been tasked to prep the old field as best they could, clearing away the squatter shacks, bushes, and concrete fragments that blocked the field. When word of what they were doing spread, civilians had started showing up to help. Retirees with garden tools, surfers with their bare hands, and now truly homeless squatters, all filling in holes in the tarmac and hacking away at the jungle. That had been unexpected good fortune. A corporal was now directing 80 of them in the cleanup of a helicopter landing site, over where the hangars used to be. That would mean Adams could keep the runway clear and still bring his attack helicopters off the ships ahead of schedule. Even better, a SEAL fire team had appeared out of the jungle with two bulldozers and a Polish Navy officer driving a massive yellow roller. He couldn't even begin to fathom where they had found construction equipment in the middle of a battle, but he'd take it.
"Sir, they're here," his aide, Lieutenant Jacobson, said.
"Thank you, Tenant,"
Adams responded, his jaw still numb.
"Clear them up."
Jacobson ordered those still on the runway to clear as an F-16 buzzed low and waggled its wings. Typical pilot hot dog bullshit, thought Adams. Despite all the work, the runway was still far too rough for any plane to land on. He forgave the pilot as the F-16 flew on toward the front, where it could do some actual good. What Adams cared most about were the big lumbering planes that were appearing in the sky, the massive C-5 Galaxies that could carry over 270,000 pounds of payload, the sleek C-141 Starlifters that had ferried troops to Vietnam and the first Gulf War, and even some of the more modern C-17 Globemasters. He knew they were the early production models, built before the full reliance on electronics. Three missiles arced up toward the planes from the east, somewhere behind enemy lines. The spray of countermeasure flares distracted one missile, and then the other two smashed into a C-5 and sent it careening into the ocean. Adams could see the F-16s in the escort. 20-millimeter Vulcan cannon firing swooped down to punish whoever had committed the transgression of harming their flock. Undeterred, the other big planes moved closer, the first wave filling the air with tiny dots that blossomed into parachutes, each C-141 dumping a string of 123 paratroopers as it flew overhead. As they landed on the airfield, Adams blessed those civilians yet again. Every filled pothole in the tarmac meant one less twisted ankle or sprained knee taking a soldier out of action. Marines ran out to help the paratroopers stow their parachutes and find their rally points. At each unit rally point, a line of civilian vehicles waited on the road leading out to the main town, just as World War I French troops had been ferried to the Battle of the Marne in Parisian buses. The 3rd Brigade Combat Team of the 82nd Airborne Division would join the Battle of Kamehameha Highway in a mix of pickup trucks, SUVs, and even a few minibuses from the local tour companies. The next wave of cargo planes came down low, almost at sea level, staggered out in a long line, one behind the other. As each plane raced down the length of the runway with its rear door open, a drogue parachute deployed out the back, caught the air, and then yanked out a large pallet. The plane then pulled up, its wings never having touched the ground, and the pallet slid and bumped down the runway at over 100 miles per hour before friction caused it to grind slowly to a stop. Teams of civilians directed by a paratrooper then swarmed over the pallet, tearing at thick belts, strapping down everything from aviation fuel bladders to combat vehicles. With all that extra manpower, the offloading went at least twice as fast as anticipated, and it freed up more forces for the front lines. Adams heard Jacobson yelling at the workers to prioritize the M1128 Stryker mobile gun systems. Damn, that boy was good. The 8-wheeled armored fighting vehicles each mounted a 105mm tank gun, which meant Adams could soon start punching back, hard. The most lethal supplies to come in on the pallets, though, were what looked like two ordinary fuel tank trucks. In fact, the tanks were not filled with fuel, but with a mix of resin-based binders.
When sprayed down and smoothed out over the base of the old runway, the substance would form polyurethane polymer concrete. After just 30 minutes of drying time, he would own the only operative airfield on the island. Adams smiled at the thought, the first smile he'd allowed himself in months. It quickly died, though, when Jacobson reached over with a handkerchief to dab away a thin trickle of drool dripping from the corner of the general's still numb mouth. Boneyard Flight, Pacific Ocean. Roscoe fired a pair of AIM-120E AMRAAM air-to-air missiles well before he could see the enemy planes. The 12-foot-long missiles came cleanly off his plane's fuselage stations and disappeared into the blue sky ahead. With so much radar and communications interference, these were the long shots. Shoot two, hope maybe to hit one. More usefully, they'd create a cover of fast-moving death for his jets to come in behind, throwing off whatever formation the enemy had planned. He pushed the plane to afterburners, noticing a faint vibration in his ejection seat as his F-15C's speed passed Mach 2. With no stealth features, the older planes would be at a disadvantage until they made this an up-close and personal knife fight. Plus, the F-15C's speed meant they could start their kill count before the slower Shrike drones arrived. It all happened in seconds. A few explosions in the distance, and closer alongside him as some of Eagle Flight were hit by the enemy's counterfire, and then a swirl of smoke and contrails as fighters from three nations mixed it up. Roscoe could focus only on his part of the fight, quickly firing a pair of AIM-9X Sidewinder missiles at two Russian MiG-35Ks less than a mile away, both of them banking hard as they tried to get inside the turn circle of another F-15. One missile went astray, but the second smashed into the trailing jet's tail section with an explosion that pitched the MiG's nose skyward and then left a smoky scar in the sky. The other MiG fighter jet turned to escape, Roscoe following. As he turned, a faint puff of tracer rounds crossed in front of him. A Chinese J-31 fighter was boring through the chaos, its nose trained on Roscoe's F-15. Before Roscoe could evade, one of the incoming rounds blew off the top of his left vertical stabilizer. The F-15 shuddered and buffeted as the J-31 bird-dogged Roscoe, staying on his rear. Instinctively, the experienced pilot unloaded the jet. While one way to gain speed was to max engine power, the most effective way was essentially to trick physics into working for you. Roscoe slid the stick forward and put the aircraft into a shallow 10-degree dive. As the plane dipped slightly, it created a zero-G condition, essentially unloading weight from the plane, akin to going over the crest of a small hill on a bicycle and coming out of your seat. Acceleration is a matter of thrust and weight, and in that weightless moment, Roscoe's F-15 powered ahead rapidly, leaving his attacker behind. As Roscoe saw the airspeed indicator approaching the plane's structural design limits, he felt a sharp shudder, the damaged tail wing starting to crack. The jet's designers hadn't counted on the effect of a 30-millimeter cannon. As Roscoe pulled the stick up to lose speed, his radar warning receiver howled. The J-31 was catching up to finish him off. He pushed the throttles all the way forward, rolled the plane onto its back, and pulled the stick back into the seat pan. He hoped that the directorate pilot would get greedy, cut across his turn circle, and provide him a reversal opportunity. It was a classic move, which unfortunately meant it was one the J-31 pilot had been trained to counter. Roscoe snuck a look over his shoulder and saw the directorate plane stabilized at his deep 6 o'clock, between his tail. Roscoe swung the plane back and forth, straining against the force of the turns, trying to ruin the J-31's firing solution, but knowing his bag of tricks was empty. His plane groaned with the turns. If a Chinese missile didn't kill him, his jet would. His flight suit compressed and fought the G-forces just as Roscoe pulled into another tight turn. The tunnel vision started, the perimeter of his field of vision beginning to shade inward from the massive pressure on his body. A gray form entered on the right side of his line of sight, just above his canopy, and then disappeared as the tunnel around him grew smaller and smaller. He was blacking out, he knew it. Roscoe pulled out of the turn. The tunnel widened, and the heavy weight on his body lifted.
The plane's radar warning receiver abruptly went silent. He craned his neck to see where the J-31 was. He couldn't find it at first. And then he saw the matte gray and blue Chinese fighter falling end over end toward the ocean below, trailing a thick plume of smoke and flame. Flying away was a Shrike. The wedge-shaped drone pulled an insanely tight turn that would have knocked out any human pilot, firing a missile at a MiG-35K in the midst of it. Even before that MiG exploded, the Shrike was already off hunting its next target, its autonomous programming relentless in its computerized efficiency.
"Little bastard didn't even stop to see if I was okay,"
said Roscoe, silently thanking the drone's designers. He checked his radar display, which was momentarily free of jamming strobes. He felt sick when he saw how empty the sky was of aircraft. In less than a minute, at least 100 lives had been lost.
"Longboard, Longboard, this is Boneyard Leader. We've received most of your visitors, but I show 8 leakers made it through our picket line. MiG-35Ks," he said, trying to steady his voice as his plane bucked. "We're going to run them down, but it looks like some bogeys are going to make it to you first. Over."
The 4 F-15s remaining in Eagle flight took off in pursuit at almost 900 miles an hour, their maximum at low altitude. The low fuel warning flashed in Roscoe's cockpit. Going to afterburner so much would cost him the chance to get home, he thought. But that was beside the point at this stage of the game. He visually picked up the Russian MiGs by the telltale signs of their missile launches. The remains of Eagle flight had arrived too late.
"Jesus, that's a lot of hurt," said Roscoe to the other 3 pilots. "I count at least 2 dozen missiles."
"At least 30,
said Squiggle, the pilot in the F-15C flying off Roscoe's right wing.
"Fire everything you have left. Use 'em or lose 'em,"
Roscoe ordered. He fired off his remaining AIM-9X, visually following it as it locked on one of the MiGs trailing the formation. The MiG was breaking upward, climbing for more altitude after launching its anti-ship missiles, when the Sidewinder exploded just aft of the jet.
"Eagle flight, I'm Winchester,"
Roscoe said, letting whoever was left know he was down to guns only. He pushed his jet past the MiG flat spinning into the waves below, maxing the power to try to run down the crew's missiles starting to accelerate into the distance. Above him, the Russian and American jets grappled in a final violent confrontation that took 6 Russian missiles and 2 more MiGs out of the sky, but also resulted in the destruction of 3 of the 4 American F-15s. He'd hoped to catch one of the missiles with a lucky shot from his guns, but his luck had run out. The F-15's damaged vertical stabilizer broke away like a shingle in a hurricane.
"So there's me,"
said Roscoe to himself as he struggled with the bucking plane. He eyed the ocean below, looking for the driest spot to ditch in. The left engine began to sputter. His war would end now. Roscoe took his left hand off the stick and reached for the yellow metal bar by his knee, on which his crew chief had jokingly written "Do not touch" in felt-tip marker. The plane's violent pitching made getting a grip on the ejection handle far harder than he'd expected. USS Zumwalt Ship Mission Center.
26 missiles incoming, sir, said Richter, with the kind of detachment that often accompanies extreme fear. Athena shows Port Royal counterfiring.
While not of the same design, the Port Royal was a sister ship of sorts to the Z. She had been the youngest of the Navy's Ticonderoga-class cruisers, and one of the first with the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles as part of the Navy's linebacker program. But in 2009, when it ran into a coral reef about a half mile from the Honolulu airport, the ship earned a new cruel nickname, the Port Coral, as it had become known. Didn't sink, but the extensive damage to the ship's hull, propellers, and sonar dome put the U.S. Navy's then youngest cruiser on the target list for early retirement to the Ghost Fleet. The Port Royal fired a wave of SM-6 air defense missiles that sped upward from the vertical launchers embedded in its deck. The missiles arced up and then pitched down toward the low-flying cruise missiles. A wave of RIM-162 evolved Sea Sparrow defense missiles followed. The collisions were almost instantaneous, showering the ocean surface with flame, fuel, and metal shards.
"I count that as 14 hits, sir.
We have 12 still incoming, said the sailor.
Full countermeasures and launch the Utah, said Simmons.
A large metal canister that had been affixed to the Zumwalt's stern separated from the ship with a loud bang. It popped 30 feet into the air and then dropped into the water with an anticlimactic splash, bobbing up and down. Vern, who had been out on the deck checking a power cable connection during a lull in the railgun fire, stopped to watch as the massive gray form the Z was leaving behind began inflating. Mike ran up to her, yelling,
"We need to get back inside."
Vern gave him a puzzled look and then returned her attention to the growing form, the words USS Utah unfurling on its side in white paint as it inflated. "What is it?"
"Now, Vern, move!"
Mike half carried her roughly back to the shelter of the main superstructure. He steered her below decks and talked at the same time, occasionally pausing to catch his breath.
USS Utah was an old World War I battleship. By the time of the first Pearl Harbor attack, it had been turned into a floating naval target ship for our own gunners to practice on. But when the Japanese attacked in 1941, their pilots saw what looked from above like a real battleship. The old Utah was sunk, but not before she soaked up a ton of bombs that the enemy could have used on other better targets. Our Utah is supposed to do the same.
As they descended deeper into the ship, the matte gray bag behind the Z continued to expand until it formed the silhouette of a small warship, with metallic reflective squares on it enhancing its signature. With a jerk, the towline finally paid out a quarter mile behind the ship, and the Utah now followed the Zumwalt, matching its speed.
"Sir, Athena says the incoming missiles are selecting targets 20 seconds out," said the sailor in the mission center.
"Athena, full autonomous mode. Authorization, Simmons, 4-7, Romeo, Tango, Delta," said Simmons quickly.
The ship's laser point defense fired first. There was no noise or visible light, and only faint, almost delicate movements as the solid-state high-energy laser fired. It was a moment of faith for the crew, as the weapon lacked the certainty of gunpowder. The ship's laser gun camera showed a small flame spark on the target as the 100-kilowatt beam came into contact with it. The missile caught fire and sank into the water. Then Athena automatically directed it to track and fire on a second missile. At the same time, two Metal Storm computerized machine gun turrets on the Zumwalt's port and starboard sides came out of sleep mode. The weapons started to move back and forth, tracking the incoming cruise missiles with what looked like a predator's patience. Then they locked targets and fired. The brief electronic zipping sound the guns made when they fired was as anticlimactic as it was effective. Thousands of bullets shot out all at the same instant. The Russian Zvezda KH-31 missiles were programmed to feint and dodge as they flew just above the ocean's surface in order to complicate a defense's firing solution. That tactic was of no use against the Metal Storm, as the missiles flew right into what was almost literally a wall of bullets.
"Seven missiles left," said the tactical action officer.
"Activate Utah's radar beacon," said Simmons.
The remaining seven missiles' ramjets kicked in, accelerating them to near 3 times the speed of sound as they closed on the task force, flying just 50 feet above the rippling sea surface. As another missile was plucked away by a laser fire, the missiles broke formation like a startled flight of birds. Their targeting program picked out the largest ships in the task force. Two missiles vectored off toward the Zumwalt. Two turned for the USS New York, a 25,000-ton amphibious transport dock ship. Two honed in on the USS America. Aboard the Zumwalt, the Metal Storm turrets zip-fired again, and one of the incoming missiles turned toward the America disappeared with a spray of shrapnel. Simmons held his headset mic close to his mouth with one hand and braced himself against the railing of the ship mission center's second story with the other, looking at the sailors below him.
All hands, incoming missiles, prepare for impact.
As the two missiles sped toward Zumwalt, one appeared to twitch. It broke off and slammed into the Utah. The missile's electronic brain registered what a human brain would have felt as satisfaction when it found its supposed target. The decoy chip exploded with a massive eruption of air and water.
The second cruise missile stayed true to its targeting software designer's intent. It made a final course correction, and then enveloped the Zumwalt in a bloom of orange flame. The explosion rocked the ship, sending a shockwave through the mission center and tossing the captain over the balcony's railing. When he came to, Simmons found himself on the lower level of the ship's mission center. He pulled himself up by the arm of the radar operator's chair. Richter reached over and gave him a hand, and then turned back to her screens. His back ached, but otherwise he seemed fine. Less so the room. Two of the wall screens had fallen off their mounts, one hitting the tactical action officer, who looked to have a broken collarbone. Acrid smoke made Simmons's eyes water.
"Somebody get the air back on!" he shouted.
He looked for Cortez. He had been beside him a second ago, but now he was gone.
"XO damage report," said Simmons.
The air started to clear in the room as the fans switched on, but the stink of fire and plastic remained. If they made it through, they were going to smell like this for weeks, Simmons mused.
"EV system back online, sir," said Cortez.
He tracked the ship's self-diagnostics on his glasses.
"Working on the damage report."
The voice came from the room's upper deck. Simmons raced back up the steps and saw Cortez kneeling, helping a sailor into his chair. Cortez stood, straightened his glasses, and gave Simmons the battle damage update as far as he knew it. The missile warhead had detonated just four of the superstructure. The good news was all the fires were contained to the impact site, and Athena, propulsion, and radar were online. The rest was bad news. The only operative external camera showed smoke and flame shrouding the ship's forward superstructure, blackening the whole surface. The laser turret on that side had evidently popped out of its mount before it settled back into place. The shock of the explosion had knocked loose power cables across the ship.
"Damage control team is already on the way," he said. "Firebots and ship's suppression system are operative."
Two more of the monitors flickered back on as more of the ship's external cameras rebooted. The faces of both officers fell at the images. The New York listed over on its port side, almost at a 45-degree angle to the water's surface. The image zoomed in on the two smoldering holes in the side of its hull, which were sucking more and more water into the bowels of the ship, dragging it down. Sailors leaped from the superstructure into the flaming waters around it, only to disappear as the ship rolled over on top of them. Better off was the America, but not by much. The missile had apparently gone into the opening of its elevator lift. The delicate-looking mushroom cloud hung above the hole ripped in its flight deck. Secondary explosions from aviation fuel stored below punched jets of flame out into the air. Yet for all the smoke and fire, the ship looked steady in the water.
"How many?" said Simmons.
New York had already disembarked most of their Marines, so Athena is reporting 500-plus KIA or missing. America, another 825. "Those numbers will change as data updates," Cortez replied softly.
"I'm in our ship," said Simmons.
"System shows 7 dead, 22 wounded," said Cortez. "4 missing."
"My dad?"
asked Simmons, lowering his voice. He squinted, suppressing something he didn't want to feel now or ever.
"No, sir. He's registering as active with the damage control team below decks," said Cortez, placing his glasses on top of his head, transfixed by the sight of the hull of the now capsized New York slipping under the waves.
Simmons didn't allow himself to feel any relief at the news. He gripped the railing until the tendons in his hands surrendered to the pain. The discomfort cleared his head and focused his attention.
"Helmsman, move us over parallel to the America," said Simmons. "They're going to need our help fighting those fires."
USS Zumwalt, below decks. Mike followed the caterpillar-like firebot down the smoky passageway, knowing it would lead him to where he was needed most.
"Hit it over there," he heard Davidson say, his voice muffled through a smoke hood.
Already, the blaze was nearly under control. Brooks wielded an extinguisher, spraying foam and coolant on the seared metal and melted composite. Davidson gave the mohawked kid a thumbs up, the kind of silent compliment that meant the most to the young man. The firebot scooted ahead and detonated its fire retardant chemical payload near the Russian missile's impact point. As the smoke cleared, daylight from the irregular oval hole in the deck above them punched through with a spotlight's intensity. Mike had Brooks spray the walls again, and he climbed up carefully to put his head through, so he could see the deck side damage. The missile appeared to have struck as the ship rolled, which deflected its blast skyward, not into the hull. The heat, though, had seared the entire superstructure, melting the composite material into something that looked more like cooled lava than the creased lines of the radar-deflecting design. He took in the wider view beyond, the Z edging closer to the burning USS America, two of its fire hoses spraying toward it. Mike looked down and spotted a figure splayed out on a litter being rushed somewhere by another sailor and a corpsman. It was Parker. The big sailor was crying as he tried to move a blackened arm. Mike rested his head on his forearm briefly, suddenly fatigued, and then began to climb down.
"Superstructure's all melted to shit," said Mike, pulling off his smoke hood.
Davidson did the same, coughing slightly. Brooks left his hood on.
"Take off your hood, Mo. Surgeon General's orders. It's not the smoking that's going to kill you today," said Mike, inhaling deeply.
Brooks reluctantly pulled the hood off and blinked bloodshot eyes. Mike turned to Davidson.
"We need to seal and reinforce that material up there. If we get into any kind of seas, it's going to get wet down here fast."
"When's that going to happen?" said Davidson. "Chinese missiles don't care about whatever sea state we're in."
"No," said Mike, "but I do. Take care of the ship, and it'll take care of you. You should know that by now."
"We can slap some epoxy and Kevlar ply up there, then brace it. Sound good?" said Davidson, digging in his right ear, trying to clear it.
"It'll do," said Mike. "Your ear's okay?"
Davidson nodded and said, "Everything's tinny sounding, but don't worry, Chief. I can still hear you if you need to chew my ass out." The radio slung over Mike's right shoulder started to squawk.
"Chief, this is the captain,"
his son said, as if he needed to identify himself to his own father.
"What's your status, over?"
"I'm okay, but we're counting multiple wounded, mainly burns and broken bones and burst eardrums. We got a hole about 12 foot wide and some fire and heat damage. You can kiss whatever stealth signature we had goodbye. Fortunately, the missile didn't dig too deep. No structural damage that I can see. Main laser turret is going to need some major repair hours to get back into alignment. But we look to still be in business with the railgun. I've got a damage control party working on the hull. It's above the waterline, but I want to seal it up."
"Thank you, Chief.
I knew I could count on you," his son said.
Mike could hear the relief in his voice, and he wasn't sure whether it was for him or for the role he was filling. Today, either would do. USS Zumwalt Ship Mission Center. Captain Simmons felt a tap on his shoulder, Cortez letting him know they had finally gotten the link to the task force command network back up. The video image filled the display screen, and Jamie looked at a grim-faced officer, Commander Alexander Anderson. Years ago, when he and Jamie were both just out of ROTC, they had served together on board the USS Chafee. Anderson now had command of the Port Royal, which had pulled to the other side of the America and was adding the water from its fire hoses to help beat down the flames.
"Jamie, it's good to see you in one piece," said Anderson.
The officer had a slim face and narrow shoulders, and his uniform always looked slightly oversized. It was as if any extra calories his body had went to fueling his legendary brain.
"Same here," said Simmons. "Ship's holding together. Crew too. We're still in the fight. Any word from Admiral Murray?"
"She's gone, sir," said Anderson,
shifting back to a formal tone now that he saw his old friend was unhurt. "Confirmed by the America's quartermaster, a petty officer who seems to be all that's left in command there. Reports all power out. She had to yell over to us with a bullhorn." He paused. "Captain Simmons, you know what this means. If that petty officer is right, and we have to assume she is, at this point, with Admiral Murray dead and Captain Brookings on the America—"
"I'm task force commander," Simmons said, realizing what Anderson was saying.
"Yes, sir," said Anderson. "Longboard is yours. We're in good hands, I know it."
The two of them went silent for a few seconds
as the moment sank in, and then they turned to business. With your permission, sir, I'd like to begin evacuating the America's crew. Simmons nodded, even as he was trying to make up his mind. I don't like the idea of scuttling a ship still afloat, Anderson continued, but I like the idea of towing a 40,000-ton weight with an enemy fleet coming in behind us even less. Simmons finally realized what Anderson assumed their next course of action would be.
We are not leaving behind either America or the Marines on shore, said Simmons. We will evacuate the wounded off the ship, but hold this line of position until our main fleet or the enemy's arrives, whichever happens first.
Anderson shifted slightly sideways, as if he didn't quite believe what he was seeing and hearing. His eyes squinted, and his brow wrinkled in what Simmons recognized was an eloquent objection forming, the kind of argument they might have had back in the Chafee's wardroom when they were young officers. Then the look washed away, and Anderson nodded, with an exaggerated bob of his head.
Yes, sir, he said. We have to locate the enemy, said Simmons. It's that simple. I'm ordering Agenal out on picket duty and deploying all our fire scouts to maximum range. And God help us if they don't find what's out there coming for us.
Vicinity of USS America, Pacific Ocean. He'd been close to greatness, thought Denisov. And yet now, here he was, wondering whether he should try to take off his flight boots for added buoyancy. He slowly kicked his legs, knowing he was too far offshore to do anything but drift until something ate him, or one of the American ships in the near distance plucked him from the water. He lay back against the collar of his inflated life vest, watching the strange, thin, wedge-shaped American drones circle high overhead. They were now flying a combat air patrol against an airstrike that wouldn't come.
I was it, you stupid Aftermath. There's no more, he screamed.
Mindless machines, but lethal. He had to give them that. A tingling at the back of his neck made him spin around. Seen from thousands of feet in the air, the Pacific looked inviting. But floating in it, he thought these waters were as dark and foreboding as his worst nightmare. Something was nearby, he could feel it. An enormous black shape slowly moved through the sea, maybe 30 yards beneath him. It surfaced a few hundred feet away, puffed a blast of air, and then went back under. No shark could be that big. He sighed with relief. A humpback whale, perhaps, content to eat krill, not Russian pilots. He was alone for a little while longer. He was close enough to see the still-smoking USS America, and was confident the little aircraft carrier had been the one his missile had hit. He watched the chiseled form of a massive destroyer pull alongside it. Sailors appeared to be tethering the ships together. He recognized it as the Zumwalt-class ship and decided instead that had been the one his missile had hit. Far better to have hit the more exotic creature with his last shot. With his eyes stinging from the salt and sun, Denisov watched the litters of wounded men and women being passed off the burning America via zip lines strung between the two vessels. The sailors were bound up like mummies as they traveled from their dying ship to another with an uncertain future. From the stern of the strange-looking ship, three small forms lifted off. When they formed up, he identified them as MQ-8 Fire Scout drones, scaled-down helicopters with pinched noses that looked like they had never made it out of aviation adolescence. Another two lifted off from the ship, tethered to the other side of the America, some kind of cruiser or destroyer he couldn't tell. The drone helicopters paused in formation, and then each set off in a different direction, looking like foraging steel wasps. They flew low, hugging the waves. One of the fire scouts flew almost directly overhead, the drone oblivious to Denisov, as the force of its rotor's downdraft pushed him under the waves. At that moment, Denisov realized that maybe the Americans wouldn't come for him. USS Zumwalt Ship Mission Center. The tactical holograph still hadn't come back on, so the fuzzy image was carried across the entire bank of monitors on the wall. Given how the holographic projectors seemed to get knocked offline in every fight, Simmons wondered why they even bothered with the finicky high-tech contraptions. The grainy image they were watching looked like one of those old low-resolution YouTube videos.
Sir, the task force is a mix of Chinese and Russian ships, said the Zumwalt's intelligence officer, and Athena agrees, based on the EM signatures the fire scout is picking up. The live image kept shaking as if somebody were swatting at the drone, but the shaking was only the drone's autonomous flight software keeping the rotorcraft as low as possible to the waves, dipping into the troughs between them for cover.
Freeze that for me, said Simmons.
The image on the screen locked, and the officer zoomed in on the superstructure of a large ship that the long-range camera had picked up on the upward ride of a wave.
What a beast. That's gotta be the Zhanghe.
Yes, sir. Looks like it, said the intelligence officer. He moved the still image of the massive Chinese capital ship off to one screen and resumed the live camera view. The video feed began to jiggle and shake, and the fire scout picked up speed, giving up its cover, as the wind shifted and the troughs of the waves grew shallow. It was a panic move, the robot's algorithms having run out of good options to evade detection. The shaking image then showed a series of smoky trails lifting up from the task force and flying toward the camera.
Uh-oh,
was all the intelligence officer could say before the image blanked out. Cortez spoke up, reading from his glasses, as Simmons watched the replay of the fire scout's frantic final moments. Between the visuals and SIGINT collection, Athena is reporting it as 7 surface ships, 3 Savramini-class anti-surface destroyers, 2 Type 54 frigates, 1 Luoyang-class guided missile destroyer, and a battle cruiser, most likely the Admiral Zhanghe.
They're making 25 knots. They're likely coming at us off a loose fix they got from the air attack.
Simmons took in the small amount of information he had and realized he needed to think like an admiral and consider the entire longboard task force, not just his own ship.
But where are the carriers? Said Simmons out loud, mostly to himself.
No further information, sir, said